I want to speak to you this morning from Psalm chapter 88, and I am Scott, one of the pastors here, and glad to be with you. And it's really dark out there and really bright right here. It's going to take a second to figure out who's out there, but glad you're with us. And Romans chapter 5, there's a little phrase in there that says, we rejoice in our sufferings. And I don't know about you, I don't know about your life, but one of the hardest things to do is to rejoice in sufferings. We all like happy endings. We all love the little phrase, they lived what? Right after they got married. And they, all of you know, 5 minutes after you got married, it wasn't happily ever after. Right? I mean, the reality is that the problem is that with all the movies we watch, all the books we read, is that our life doesn't match that. There are very few, if ever, happy endings. Most people's experience of this life is filled with darkness. Most people's life is filled with tragedy. Most people's lives are filled with even eventually finding death. In America, we have a heightened sense of this happily ever after, because I think in many ways we've lived in a culture that is like no other culture has ever experienced in all of humanity, where at the edge, we feel like we can get to that happily ever after place. We live longer. We can find medicine to cure almost everything that we deal with. And yet, if you're honest with yourself, your life is filled with suffering. And if you haven't been there yet, I jokingly say, wait 5 minutes. Suffering is coming to all of us. In fact, Psalm 88, the passage that Eric read for us this morning, may be one of the most horrific chapters in all of the Bible. I don't know how you paid attention to that particular psalm, but it wasn't filled with a lot of hope, was it? There wasn't a lot of joy. There wasn't a lot of like praise. There wasn't a lot of celebration. In fact, there was absolutely none of it. And what Psalm 88 does, it reminds us of our humanity. It reminds us of who we are as people. So 6 years ago this week, December 7th, 2012, I have a picture for you. This is a picture of my family, like 6 months before all of this happened. 6 years ago and 2 days ago, my wife went in for her very first brain surgery. We found out that she had brain cancer. And so 6 years ago, we began to battle what it was like to have brain cancer. And she came out of that particular surgery, and we lived the next 3 years of our life basically normal. In fact, in many ways, the best 3 years of our married life together with our kids. And about 2.5 years ago, my wife went back in for another surgery, and she battled brain cancer for the rest of her life after that as well. And the Lord took her in 2.5 years ago, June 13th, 2016. And if you know my journey, many of you do, many of you don't, there's a dark night of the soul when God wants to take your spouse, when God wants to take your father, when God wants to take your child. And the closer that the suffering comes to you, the closer that it actually impacts you, the darker the night, the darker the soul. In many ways, I resonate not in the same categories of the psalmist in Psalm 88, but in many ways, the feelings, the emotions, and the expectations. What's fascinating about Psalm 88 is that it is the only psalm in the entire book of Psalms that doesn't end with hope. In fact, throughout the book of Psalms, there's always these types of psalms. We call them the lament psalms. That's just a fancy word for complaining. Okay? There's all these complaining psalms. You just open up the psalms, and over half of them, the psalmist is doing what? He's complaining to God. And yet, in every one of those complaining psalms, there is always at the end a hint of hope. There is always a celebration. There's always praise to be given. And so all these psalms turn from like complaining into what? Joy. Into lament, into happiness, into praise. And the very last word in the Hebrew of Psalm 88 is what word? It's actually in the ESV as well. It's the word darkness. Psalm 88 is unique because it is the only psalm written that does not end in hope. it actually ends with the word darkness. There is no response from God in Psalm 88. There is no happy, great feelings. I'm just going to throw it out there. Caleb is not out there making you just feel like everything is good. Okay? For the psalmist, he comes to this point and he says, life sucks. And there is no, coffee cup verse that says, if you don't see what he's doing, just trust his heart. Like these weird little statements, right? Now, at the end of the psalm, it is, my life is filled with darkness. And we're not alone. Great Christian men and women throughout the history of the church have experienced dark nights of the soul, champions of the faith, people that we would put on pedestals, if you will, and say, these are the greatest Christians of all time. One of those great Christians of all time is an English preacher. His name is Charles Spurgeon. And he wrote things like this. He said, I could weep by the hour like a child. I didn't even know what I was crying for. This iron bolt of depression was so mysteriously fastened to the door of hope, and it holds my spirit in a gloomy prison. And I'm subject to depression so fearful that I hope that none of you ever get to the extremes of wretchedness as I go to. Like, this is like one of the greatest preachers of all time. Would have to just leave England and go to France and just deal with this deep, deep, dark suffering of depression. And so in Psalm 88, the psalmist is having a dark night of the soul. And let's walk through Psalm 88 quickly together and point out a few things. And as we look at this psalm, it can be divided up into three sections. And each one of these sections has this idea of the psalmist crying out to God, talking to God. And in verses 1 through 9, we see this phrase in the middle of verse 1. It says this, I cry out to you when? Day and night. He begins this statement of lament, of complaining to God and saying, God, this is what I'm doing to you. I am calling out every day and every night to you. I am crying out for help. I am in deep distress. I am experiencing a deep bitterness. And what I find very fascinating is we'll see that this bitterness that he's crying out for help for is actually a bitterness directed at God. Can you believe that in the Bible, a psalmist is actually having bitterness towards God and it's recorded? We would think, what a heathen, what a pagan. And yet here we have an author crying out to God and filled with bitterness. Look at verse 3, it says this, my soul is full of trouble. Usually this word full is used positively to depict being satisfied, like we're filled with all of these really good things, all of this blessing is coming out. And what the irony here is that it's the exact opposite right now. His whole life is filled with troubles. I don't know if you've ever experienced your life filled with troubles, but you ever been to a part of your life where your family's a mess, your job's a mess, your exercise life is a mess, every area of your life is a mess? You ever been there? Ever been to a point where it's not just that a mess, but it seems like bad things are happening and suffering is impacting every one of those? This is what the psalmist is saying. I am to a place where I am like a dead man walking. I feel dead. I feel like I have no vitality, no life. I'm just walking around life. Verse 7, it says he's been hit by wave after wave after wave. It seems like when God is producing suffering or bringing suffering into our lives, it usually isn't just one wave that hits us, is it? If we're honest with our lives, it's like we get smacked with a wave, we get smacked with another wave. And each one of those waves seems to grow and get bigger as the cumulative effect comes upon us. But also notice this, like in verses 6 and 7. Not only is this man just filled with trouble, not only does he feel like he's just got no life, he's just dead, but who is he blaming for all of this? It says, you have put me in the depths of the pits. Your wrath lies heavy. You overwhelm me with all of your waves. In other words, God has the power to act, God has the power to deliver this individual from all of these waves, from all of these trials, from all of this suffering. And what is God doing? The exact opposite. Rather than bringing him up out of the pit, rather than stopping all the waves, what is God doing? He's deepening the pit. He's bringing more waves. God is not passively doing this. He is actively bringing this trial and these sufferings upon him. And the psalmist looks up at God and says, "You're doing this. You're doing it." The second section also begins with this exclamation in verse 9, in the middle of verse 9. It says, "Every day I call upon you." So it's day and night, and now it's just during the day he's crying out to God. And in the second section, there's a long list of rhetorical questions, like questions that have the implied answer to them. So questions like, "God, do you do miracles for dead people?" What's the implied answer? No, you don't do miracles for dead people. Do the dead people rise up and give you praise? Can those in the grave actually declare who you are and your unfailing love? Can they proclaim your faithfulness? Can the darkness speak of your wonderful words? Can anyone in the land of forgetfulness talk about your righteousness? What the psalmist is saying is, like, all these people that want, all these things you want your people to be doing, praising you and declaring how great you are, requires that people actually be alive. That they actually have the ability to do this. And he's actually crying out to God and saying, all day long, this is what I want you to do. I want you to do miracles through me so everyone can see how great you are. The psalmist understands, I believe, that there is life after death. And he's not saying that there isn't this life that we will enjoy after we die on a new creation. What I think he's getting at is he's begging God to actually work right now. I think it's like Christians, we are content with, like, we pray the prayers, become Christians, we live our Christian life, and we know that all of our hope is where and when? Afterwards, right? And I don't want to minimize our hope and the joy of our afterlife on the new world that God will come and give to us. But what this actually highlights is that the psalmist cares about his life right now. That his life right now is meaningful. That his life has purpose. And God, I know I have that life after that, but what about this life right here? Do you care about that? Are you going to answer me? Are you going to come and speak into this life right now? If we could translate it and just put it very bluntly, the psalmist is saying, God, why aren't you doing anything in my life right now? Why aren't you delivering me? Why aren't you stopping all of these waves? You ever ask God, are you ever just going to show up? Are you going to come? Are you going to do anything? Are you going to leave me here? The third and final section after all these rhetorical questions begins in verse 13. And now he says, I'm going to cry out for help in the morning. My morning prayers come before you. In many ways, this section reiterates the previous themes of, like, the first section primarily that we've already talked about, but it focuses more on the personal nature as to why God is not listening. After all this declaration of his life and all these things he wants God to be doing, now he's actually coming to a more personal nature and saying, God, why are you doing this to me? You're doing it. I want you to do it in my life right now. But now the question is, God, what about me? Why do you cast my soul away? Why do you hide your face from me? Your wrath is swept over me. Your assaults are destroying me. And I think we come to this place in our suffering where we actually cry out to God. He's not there. We're like, God, act. And when he's not acting, it becomes very personal, doesn't it? It becomes like, God, what about me? Are you going to do anything? Are you going to actually show up? Do you love me anymore? So that we could actually, I think, say the flow of the passage is this. God, where are you? God, what is happening? And God, do you care about me? I don't know if you've ever experienced the dark night of the soul. But these are the questions that we ask in the dark night of the soul. God, where are you? What are you doing? And do you even care about me? So I would just ask, where are you? Have you experienced a dark night of a soul? Do you feel like the psalmist right now, potentially? To one degree or another, all of us have experienced darkness. Darkness is shading all of our life. Are you asking God these questions? Why aren't you responding to me? Why aren't you communicating with me? Do you still love me? Or as we'll see throughout this passage, as we continue, God, what about my troubles? Why, when I pray to you, nothing happens? Why do I feel like your wrath is so heavy upon me? Why do I feel like you're nowhere around me? And God, where are all my friends? So I don't know about you, but I'd ask this question. What do you do with Psalm 88? What do you do in the dark night of the soul when you get to the very end of all these questionings of God and you're in the midst of that darkness and all you can experience is this bitterness and this anger and this real deep, deep darkness? Where do you go? What does Psalm 88 tell us to go? Let me give you three things this morning where I think we should go when Psalm 88 actually hits us. When we're in that dark, deep part of the soul, the first thing I want us to think about is this. When God doesn't seem to answer, our suffering should not lead us away from belief in God. The first thing I want us to be encouraged that is that when we go through this suffering, it should not lead us to stop believing and stop having faith in our God. Great suffering in people's lives often leads them away from God. I don't know, I'm not trying to pinpoint or be mean to anyone, but most of my friends who don't believe in God at the present time, when I start to talk about their life and why they don't believe in God, almost every time it goes back to what? Some deep, deep suffering in their life that they ask questions like, if there is a God, why would he allow that? You ever been there? In fact, one of the main objections to Christianity goes something like this. If a good and powerful God exists, so if there's a loving, good God and an all-powerful God, why would he allow pointless evil? And just to be honest, you know, I'm thinking to myself a few years ago and even this week on the treadmill, God, I'm a pastor. I'm trying to serve you. And you took Shelley from me? That's pointless, right? I mean, that's ridiculous. You should have taken me. She was way better than me. Like, the point is that you get to this place where you actually begin to think, God, if you're loving, why'd you do that? And if you're all-powerful, why didn't you just snap your finger and heal her? And so the great objection to Christianity that moves us away from God is this idea that this good and all-powerful God exists. Why is there so much suffering in the world? But I would actually want to encourage you with this statement. That when you go through suffering, rather than actually making it move away from God, it should actually move you to a deeper belief in God. What do I mean by that? Number one, I'd say it this way, that those who go through great suffering in their life, as I mentioned, often think that the things they're experiencing, the trials, the sufferings, are just pointless things. That suffering is pointless. Life is pointless. And when we get to this place in your darkness and in the place in your life where you actually begin to think, this is all just meaningless, it's pointless, there's no rhyme or reason, we have to begin and peel back a few layers and ask questions like this. How do I know it's pointless? See, tucked underneath this assertion that suffering is pointless is this hidden premise, this hidden idea, this hidden agenda is simply this, that if evil appears pointless to me, then it must be what? Pointless. And if your mind can't fathom how this could actually be good, then you go the opposite route. And you make it pointless. So just because you can't see or imagine any good reason why God would allow suffering doesn't mean there isn't one. Let me repeat that. Just because you can't imagine that there's not a good reason for suffering doesn't mean that there isn't one. I don't know if you're a camper or like to go hiking or not, but you ever heard of these little bugs called no-see-ums? And like when you go into your tent, you look and you see this Saint Bernard there, you're like, oh, there's a dog. But when you walk into your tent, you don't see these little bugs flying around, do you? And one particular philosopher says this about that. He says, on the same basis, many assume that there were good reasons for suffering. They'd be accessible to our human minds. We'd be able to see them like the dog. But why should that be the case? Just because you cannot know the reason, just because you can't see the no-see-ums, doesn't mean they're not there. What it means is that there actually is a reason, and you just can't see it. So if you can't come up with any reason why your suffering is good or why it's taken place, then in your own mind, you say this is meaningless and pointless. And underneath that is a faith commitment, and your faith commitment says this, is that I am God. And until I can actually see that there is reason for this, I'm going to view it as pointless. So rather than putting your trust in an almighty God who has a reason that he has not revealed to you, you are putting your trust in your own understanding. And one statement that is, there's been a few things I believe that God has kept me in the faith, and this is one of these statements that has kept me in the faith over the last 3 years, is simply this. If we know what God knows, we would ask for exactly what he gives. If we know or knew what God knows, we would ask exactly for what he gives. What does that mean? It means simply this, church. Like, if I don't think we'll ever be able to see this, honestly, but if we could, see God's roadmap of all of human existence, and we could understand all the interconnectivities of all the things that are going on in this world, of which my life and my wife and my family is just a small blip of it. And you could actually see all the interconnectivities of it and all the things that happened and all the things that God did. You know what we'd be saying? God, when you put me in the dark night of the soul, it was the most wise thing you could ever have done. We'd actually be saying, God, that is brilliant. It sucks, but oh my word, of course that's why you did that. If we knew what God knows, we would ask for exactly what he gives. So don't run in the darkness of your soul to just say this is pointless. And further than that, if you go that route, and you begin to abandon God, I want you to know it's not going to help you in your suffering. And the reason many people go to pointlessness and meaninglessness and abandon their belief in God, because they think it's going to help them in their suffering. And I want you to know it's not going to help you at all. In fact, it's going to make it worse. You see, many people, when they experience this deep grief, this dark night of the soul, they're suffering abandonment from their friends and from God, begin to ask questions like, why aren't you here? Abandoning your belief in God during suffering will not help you cope with your grief. Martin Luther King Jr., and here's one reason why, said this, and it's on the screen for you. He says, the only way I can know that a human law is unjust is if there is a divine law, a higher law from God. What does he mean by that? He's saying simply this, if there was no law from God, there is no norm of life, there'd be no way then to tell if a human law was good or bad. If there is no God, someone could say this law is unjust or this law is just. And the question that Martin Luther King is getting to is, how can you determine if something is just or unjust? You actually have to have a what? A standard, right? If there is no standard, you can't determine if something is good or bad, right or wrong, just or unjust. So how can you actually know that suffering is pointless or suffering is wrong or suffering is evil if there is no what? Standard by which to judge that. And the question that Martin Luther King is asking is simply this, is where do you get your standard to say that suffering is evil? It has to come from something higher than us. So all that to say, evil and suffering, and why God allows it to happen to people in this world, is a problem for us who believe in God. Does that make sense? We can't give you all the answers. It's a problem. I can't give you all the deep details and all the deep reasons why there's sin in the world and why there's cancer in the world and all these issues. But I want you to know that abandoning your belief in God doesn't solve any of the problems. In fact, it makes the problems even bigger. Because if there is no God, who's going to determine what's right and what's wrong? C.S. Lewis, I'll just leave you this last quote. If you know anything about his story, actually was an atheist who wanted nothing to do with God and started studying God, and God used all that study to make him believe in God. But he said this in one of his writings. And if you don't know who C.S. Lewis is, he's the one who wrote Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe and those particular books and movies. He wrote this. He says, "My argument against God is that the universe seems so cruel and unjust. But how had I got this idea of what just and unjust actually is? What was I comparing this universe with when I called it unjust? Of course, I could have given up my idea of justice by saying it was nothing but a private idea of my own, but if I did that, then my argument against God collapsed too. Why? Because the argument depended on saying that the world was really unjust, not simply that it did not happen to please my private fancies. Consequently, atheism turns out to be too simple." What is C.S. Lewis saying in that quote? He's saying basically the same exact thing that Martin Luther said, is that when I began to study what is just and unjust, that if I abandoned my belief in God, I had no idea what to even mark it against, to put the standard against. And just to say that, well, I'll determine it for myself, what is right and what is wrong, he said, how does that really work? Then I can go do whatever I want to deem it to be just, and someone can go do whatever they want to me and deem it to be just or unjust. So I want you to know that when we're in the dark nights of our soul, we're going to be tempted to think that life is meaningless and pointless, and the way to go is to abandon belief in God. But all of these thoughts, church, betray what we know to be true and what we know to be real. These thoughts are logically inconsistent, and they're incoherent to hold on to. Like, if we really want to have that this is meaningless and pointless, you got to have a standard. You got to have a God who's determining all that. And so don't run from him just because you can't figure it out. And I'd say that this might be a rational, logical argument. Does that make sense? Like, for some of us, we're very logical and rational, want to think through things. But let me move not just from a rational, logical argument, but to what I'm going to call an emotional argument. Number two, when God doesn't seem to answer, we shouldn't run from God. We actually should run to God. But number two, when God doesn't seem to answer, we should be real with him. We need to be real with God. One of the reasons this psalm stands out to me is because it resonates with our humanity, in that it shows us what it is like to be a human who is undergoing deep, deep suffering. This psalmist is a human, and he's dealing with his own pressures and his own issues and his own darkness that are seemingly destroying his life. And when he's going through all of this, what does the scriptures actually record for us? Psalm 88, one commentator says this, stands as a witness to the intent of the Psalms to speak to all of life, to remind us that life does not always have happy endings. There are cold, wintry nights of the soul when bleakness fills all of your sights and darkness is all you can see. One commentator also said this, Psalm 88 is an embarrassment to the contemporary evangelical faith. To just wash over all of the platitudes and to feel like when you're in this deep, dark suffering, you always have to be what? Happy. And never mad at God. I think what this psalm actually does is just the exact opposite. As Americans, we want to whitewash everything. We want to rely on and pass our platitudes to each other to cover the deep pain. We want to cover up the pain whatever we can, and so we use all the Christianese we've been taught growing up. But there comes a point in your life where there's no more covering up the pain. There comes a point in your life and your suffering where you're tired of faking it. This is what happens to so many people. They fake it, they fake it. They're just like doing all these happy things and trying to show everyone how great they are. And then, you ever met these people? And then like life cracks and they just go the opposite way. See, if we're filled with honesty, if we're filled with these ideas, that we're not going to hold back from telling God just how we really feel. Do you think the psalmist held back anything here? The psalmist blames God for his troubles. The psalmist is declaring his bitterness towards God in the way that God is actually conducting his life. The psalmist is wrestling with God. I've often heard growing up that these things are not spiritual to do, right? Why would we wrestle with God? Why would we want to get mad at God? Why would we want to be bitter at God? Why do we want to blame God? Because that's not what Christians do, right? Have you heard this before? And what is the psalmist doing? He's blaming God. He's wrestling with God. He's angry at God. And I think to myself, and thought to myself many times, Scott, you're going to blame God for taking Shelley and you're a pastor? Or what about you? You get bitter with God over your life because you feel bad about it because you're a Christian? In fact, what I actually want to say, and I tell people just because I feel like it's my life experience, that until you actually come to this place in your life where you can just honestly say, I am really angry at God, I don't think you're going to really move on. I don't think you're really dealing with the issues. I don't think you're human to actually lose something so close to you and never be angry at God. That is not the human experience. And I think the Psalms actually declare that for us. I mean, we love the Psalms, don't we? We're having a bad day, so we go read what? The Psalms. And we always close on those last little phrases like, oh, I'm going to praise you today. And we forget about the 16 verses of God, where are you? So, D.A. Carson, I have this on the screen for you too, a very conservative evangelical theologian wrote this. He says, there's no attempt in Scripture to whitewash the anguish of God's people when they undergo suffering. They argue with God. They complain to God. They're weeping before God. Theirs is not a faith that leads to dry-eyed stoicism, but a faith so robust that it wrestles with God. One of the ways that I have been wrestling with God in my life for the last 2.5 years is, this is really weird, but if you know me, you've probably heard this before, is through running. So I run almost every day and for a long time, for me, for a long time. And for these 40 to 50 minutes of running every day, almost all the time, at least every day, there are moments of this where I am just wrestling with God over my life. Where I'm saying things like, God, you don't know what you're doing. You know why I say that? Mainly because of my kids. What are you doing? They need a mom. I'm going to ruin them, and you all know that. That was a little too much. But thank you. Or we play the faithfulness card. God, I've been doing all of this for you. And this is what you pay me back with? There's a thing called transactive memory. And this, when I learned about this, this hit me and threw me for a month too. Transactive memory is like, there are things that, if you're married, that you and your wife know, but you don't have to remember yourself because you know what? Your wife knows them all, right? So you just forget everything because, example, right? I'm just throwing this out there. Maybe it's the opposite way, but are you like me and have 58 clickers? And my wife didn't know how to use 58 clickers, so I knew how to use all 58 clickers to turn on the TV and the other things, right? My wife didn't have to learn all that. Why? Because I knew it. And vice versa. Does that make sense? We have all this transactive memory. And I'm looking at pictures. Like, we have pictures, this picture frame in our kids' bathroom, of like when they're all kids in the tub. And I don't know who's who. I'm like, I need you to tell me, is that Alana or is that Tyler? It's just their head, okay? I'm like, there's just things where there's all of these memories that you don't remember that I didn't have to remember. Why? Because I knew Shelly knew them all. And if I needed them, I'd be like, hey, Shelly, remember that 6th birthday party that was for Owen and we went there? And she's like, yeah. And she'd tell me, I was like, oh, yeah, that's right. And I just began thinking, how much of the transactive memories have I just lost of all of my kids and all of our life together? It was crazy. It threw me. And these runs, I can, yeah, I did some really weird things in these runs, but I can remember thinking, it was a bad day, that Shelly was up there, and if I sprinted really hard, I could get to her. And so I sprinted as hard as I could, and I got there, and I was done. I was just done. And so what we come to is that I want you to be real with God in your suffering. Stop placating everyone and stop having all these platitudes that life is great. Wrestle with God. You know why? He's stronger than you. Get mad at God. He can deal with it. You know why? Because eventually his love is going to quiet your soul. Blame God for your problems. You know why? Because ultimately he's going to help you see that he put all of that blame that you're blaming him, he put all that blame on his son for you. Like, run away from God. You know why? He's faster than you. Like, there is this reality that I think we're afraid to do all of these things, and yet the Psalms are telling us over and over and over again that this is the human condition. And God, as a stronger than you, who's faster than you, who will quiet you with his love, is going to keep pursuing you all the days of your life. He's not going to stop chasing you. He's not going to stop doing what he did to Jacob and wrestling you and conforming you. And I don't think until you actually get into those real moments of your life that is when God actually shows his power, his speed, and his transforming actions in your life. Does that make sense? Because until you get there, you're relying on whose strength to overcome all of your problems? Your own. In church, you know how well you do at controlling your own life. We suck at it, but we think we're really good at it. So the Psalms teach us, I think, to be real. To actually cry out and show God how we actually feel about what he is actually doing in our lives. But there's one more piece that I want to share with you. It's not just the logical side of things, that to run away from God doesn't help at all. It's not just the emotional side that says we should actually deal with our emotions as they are, because that's where God meets us and actually changes us. And let me just say this too, is that when you look back in your life, the moments where you're going to actually see that God worked the most is when you thought God was absent the most. Because you're actually going to have to depend on him, and he's actually going to change you in those moments. But number three, as we close, when God doesn't seem to answer, I want to look at the affection piece, what we put our hope and trust in. And I want to just, not glibly, but unpack this for you, that we should always look to Jesus. This is the affections, what we love, not just our emotions, not just how we think, but now what we actually value and what we love. And when all of our spiritual energies and moral fortitudes are drained, only the cross is actually going to give you hope to keep moving. What do I mean by that? I love the psalmist here because two times he talks about waves and floods engulfing him. See, when suffering hits us the first time, we are more easily prone to play the sovereignty card and believe that God is working all things out together for good, right? So just in our own family's life, in 2004, my sister was killed in a car accident. And we could, in my own minds, play the sovereignty card. God, you're sovereign. You're in control of everything. And you're working everything out for good. And it was easier, not easy to believe that. Does that make sense? I'm not minimizing it. But it was like the first real tragedy in my life. The first real deep thing that hit us. And it was easy to play the sovereignty card. But know this, church, the more that the waves of suffering hit you, and the more severe they become, the more likely that your belief in God's sovereignty is not going to actually just work anymore. What do I mean by that? Your spiritual discipline, your belief in God's sovereignty will begin to thin out until there's nothing left. You may have heard the cliche I've mentioned a little bit, you can't see his hand but trust his heart. You ever heard that little phrase? You can't see his hand but trust his heart. You know what God is doing, but trust that he's doing things for your good. I don't know about you, but when Shelley died, you know what I couldn't do anymore? I couldn't trust his heart. Like, that's the point of that I'm getting at, is like, eventually the cliche is not going to work because you're actually going to question the very cliche itself. You're actually going to question Romans 8:28, and we know that God works together all things for good, right? And it's easy to believe that until the deep, deep, deep part of your soul gets wrecked. And then you begin saying, you know what? God, how is this good? We want to find tangible evidence of God's goodness, but what if you can't find it? What I mean by that is, when you're in that deep suffering, we are always, as I mentioned in the first point, looking for a reason and a point for why it happened, right? And until your mind can actually find a good reason, your soul will be restless. But as soon as you find a good reason, your soul becomes what? More quiet. Let me just unpack that. Are you with me on that so far? Does that make sense? Let me unpack that a little bit. Go back to 2004 when my sister was killed in a car accident. Me and my brother had this conversation. I remember it vividly. But people kept trying to tell me and my brother and encourage me that God is going to use this for his glory. That God is going to use this for his kingdom. That people are going to be saved through this. Does that make sense? Like, and so we had a huge, huge, huge memorial service. It was amazing. And God did some really unique things from what I heard there. But I want to ask this question. Is our confidence in God, or is our confidence in outcomes? What if nothing ever happened at that funeral? What if the outcome of Shelley's death, there was nothing that ever happened? What if I couldn't tangibly put my finger on something that said, this is good? What if you got to a point where you're like, you know what? I don't know if anything good has come out of that. Yeah. That's my point. You're welcome. But what I'm getting at is, in our soul, we can't find rest until we can put our finger on God, that's why you did it. And so we are constantly in our suffering and tragedies trying to locate, like, this is why God's doing it. But if you can't find that, and let me just tell you, the closer that the suffering gets to the very center of your existence, the more you're going to be questioned, like, who cares? That's not good. That's not worth it. Does that make sense? Like, this sounds awful, but I got to a point in my life, like, I don't care if anyone got saved at Shelley's funeral. I just want Shelley. Does that make sense? Like, what's good? Who's determining what's good? I'm determining what's good. And so you're going to get to that place where you're going to be like, yeah, there's nothing good in this. And so what do you do then? What do you do when you just can't anymore just cite Romans 8:28? When Romans 8:28 is not getting you through the day? Well, what I've done, and I would encourage you to think through this, is to keep reading. I think I have on the next slide, Romans 8:28 and following. But the next few verses, can you go to the next slide as well? Say things like this in Romans chapter 8. What are we going to say to these things? If God is for us, who can be against us? He, God, who did not spare his own son but gave him up for us all, how will he not also with Jesus graciously give us everything? What is Paul's point? I think Paul is getting a point here is that the reason you know that God is working all things together for our good is an argument from the greater to the lesser. The greater is this, that if God was willing to give up his son for you, if he was willing to actually turn his back on his own son for you, if he was actually willing to put his son to death for you, do you not think he's working out Shelley's death for you? If he put his own son, the crucified Son of Man, the perfect divine God-man, was put to death so that we could enjoy an inheritance on this new creation, do you not think that every detail of your life, God is working out for your good? How do we know that? It's because of Jesus at the cross. I don't need tangible, I mean, I want it, trust me, but I don't necessarily need tangible reasons why God did it to make sure he's good. I can always go back to the fact that he gave me Jesus. He gave Shelley Jesus. He gave you Jesus. And if he gave you Jesus, he's giving you everything. And it doesn't necessarily just get rid of every issue and every pain. But what it does for me is it reorients my heart and my affections to say that this is good. Whether I know it or not, whether I can put my finger on it or not. God is saying in Romans 8, he's working everything together for good because he gave you his own son. But number two, when we look to Jesus in the psalm, I want us to think of it this way, that it's not necessarily wrong to put us in this psalm, to locate yourself in this psalm, but at redemption we say the Bible is all about who? Jesus, right? And I think ultimately Psalm 88 is not first and foremost a psalm about us and our life experiences, but it's actually a psalm about who? Jesus. Who's the only one in all of Scripture of God's people who will ever have a prayer request turned down? Who's the only one who really experienced all of God's wrath upon him? Who is the only one who ever experienced abandonment from God? Who's the one at the cross where all of his friends betrayed him and left him and he was there by himself? Who is the one whose soul is full of troubles? So I think when we begin to look at Psalm 88 from this perspective, that this is actually a psalm of Jesus crying out to his Father, "What about me?" It radically changes our perspective of the psalm. It radically changes our view of our life. In all of your suffering, you may not always feel these things to be real, but these things are absolutely true because Jesus is the primary character in the psalm. And what is true is this, is that in all of your suffering, you have not been abandoned. You may feel like you've been abandoned, but you haven't been. And the reason you know you haven't been abandoned is because the only son who has ever been abandoned from the Father was Jesus. And why was he abandoned? So that you and I never would be. So there's going to be many dark nights of the soul where you feel like, God, where are you? You've left me. But you go back to Romans 8 and says, if he gave us Jesus, it's a picture that he's never going to abandon us. He's never going to leave us. He is going to keep pursuing you. He's going to keep wrestling you. He's going to keep running after you. So as I say, run, wrestle, fight, get angry. He's not leaving. Isn't that amazing? and all of your anger and all of your bitterness, he's still just coming and saying, I love you. He wants to be with you so much that he would actually give his son for you. So don't feel like you've, don't think you've been abandoned. You definitely will feel that way. Number two, we need to believe, too, that we are not experiencing God's wrath. Like when those deep things come, you begin to think, is this because of my sin? Is this because I wasn't this, or I did this, or I knew God wanted me to do this and I did that? And so we begin to have this blame game of like, God, are you doing this because of me and you're experiencing throwing your wrath on me because of my sin? When you read Psalm 88 from the perspective of Jesus, you begin to see that, no, the only person who ever experienced God's wrath, the only son or daughter of God who will ever experience God's wrath is actually the Son of God himself. So in your deepest darkest nights, God hasn't left you, and he's not doing this to get you. And finally, you're not in darkness. It's so funny, I keep using this phrase, the dark night of the soul. But you know what? You're not in darkness. The last word over your life is not the last word of this soul. The last word of your life is that you already are in the light. That there is meaning to this. You may not know what it is. There is joy possible through it, even though you can't necessarily hold on to it. There is reality going on that you can be angry and wrestle and struggle, knowing that God, because he's shown his light on you, is not going to stop shining his light on you. Because darkness was Jesus' only friends, when he was at the cross, is a guarantee that only lights will be your friends. So I want to just say that Romans 5 says we rejoice in our sufferings. And what a dumb phrase, right? What a dumb phrase. Unless you can begin to wrap your mind around why we rejoice in our sufferings. To see that there is one who ultimately underwent the deepest and most ultimate suffering, so that as we go through our sufferings, we get to experience his life more. And I don't want, there's a lot more suffering going on in our church right now than just my life over the last few years. We've been hit with more waves in the last few weeks as well. And the last thing I want us to do as a people is to begin to, A, just go all be happy Christian people. I don't want us to run away from God, but I want us to keep pressing each other into this deep belief that if God gave us Jesus, it's going to be okay. And we need to be pressing into each other's lives in such ways that we actually see that. Yeah, I'll just close with this. The way that God has shown up in our life as a family is that we actually experience God, see his presence, realize his presence through the people in our lives reaching out to us through their hands. Their hands are actually the love of God to us. Does that make sense to you? I'm not saying don't get away in your quiet place and pray with God. But I'm saying that the way that God has actually communicated his love to us, the darkness that is not really there, the way he's actually shown his light to us is through his people, through his hands. And so I would pray that as a church body, we would be people who actually extend God's love through our hands, through actually getting into people's lives and loving them and serving them. It changes you. And it keeps you. And when you're going through suffering, you're going to want people to be doing the same thing to you. So Jesus, thank you that you went through the dark night so that really we would never experience a dark night. So please not allow Satan to let us run, to abandon our belief. Help Satan not be able to help us just deal with it in platitudes, but we would actually learn to be real with you, to struggle, to share that struggle with others. And may we find comfort and hope in Romans 8:31, that if you gave us Jesus, are you not freely and graciously giving us everything?